This is VOA News in Washington. I'm Jeff Custer. Israeli officials objected Thursday to U.S. President Joe Biden's decision to pause a shipment of weapons, some weapons, to Israel amid concerns over Israel's plan to expand a military operation in Rafah that the United States does not support. Israeli Ambassador to the United Nations, Gilad Erdan, called the move a difficult and very disappointing statement to hear from a president to whom we have been grateful since the beginning of the war. Biden's stance is the toughest yet on Israel's military operations in Gaza. And in conversations with VOA's International Program, International Edition Program, analyst Rajan Menon of the Defense Priorities Policy Center said Israel's actions have become a political liability to the U.S. president, and Biden is sending a message to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
So I think he's signaling to Netanyahu that he wants an operation that minimizes civilian deaths and the displacement of civilians, because he wants the consequences not to redound to his disadvantage, he Biden.
Menon says he doubts there will be a significant stoppage of U.S. weapons supplied to Israel. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said Thursday the U.N. health body was deeply concerned about Israel's increased military activities in the southern city of Rafah, where most of Gaza's people have fled for safety. Speaking in a news conference in Geneva Thursday, Adhanom Ghebreyesus added that the WHO has no intention of withdrawing from Rafah and would stay and deliver aid alongside its partners.
WHO is coordinating the work of 20 emergency medical teams in Gaza, comprising 179 internationals from 30 countries working alongside 800 local staff. These teams are embedded in 10 existing hospitals and have established 5 field hospitals.
The WHO chief said a ceasefire is urgently needed in Gaza. This is VOA News. Russian President Vladimir Putin accused the West Thursday of risking a global conflict and said no one would be allowed to threaten the world's biggest nuclear power as Russia marked the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony reports.
Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke on Red Square on Thursday as Russia marked the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II.
Russia will do everything to prevent a global conflict, but at the same time, we will not allow anyone to threaten us. Our strategic forces are always in combat readiness.
Crowds of Russians gathered in the center of Moscow to watch the Victory Day parade. It's an annual display of Russia's military might. But this year, the parade was pared down, indicating strains born from more than 2 years of war in Ukraine. Russia showed off just one T-34 tank, though also displayed a Yars intercontinental strategic missile. No Western leaders attended the parade.
That was Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony reporting. Forecasters say more rain is headed for southern Brazil, which is still reeling from massive and deadly flooding. Associated Press correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Authorities in southern Brazil rushed to rescue survivors of the massive flooding that has killed at least 100 people. More than 230,000 people have been displaced, and much of the region has been isolated by floodwaters. Dozens of displaced people have crowded into a warehouse in Porto Alegre for shelter from the floods. 68-year-old Heitor da Silva told the AP, "I only took my documents, 3 shirts, 2 underwear, and my flip-flops. All the rest is gone." Climate scientist Alvaro da Silva says climate change is to blame.
This is what happens when we have 1.2 degrees Celsius warmer world than in pre-industrial time.
I'm Karen Chamas.
A new report from a U.S. gun safety group indicates the number of stolen guns from automobiles in the country has tripled in the last 10 years. AP correspondent Donna Warder reports.
The gun safety group Everytown has analyzed data from the FBI from 337 cities in 44 states. The group says that since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, the rate of guns stolen from vehicles has gone up nearly every year, along with a major surge in weapons purchased in the U.S. And in some cases, the stolen weapons have turned up at crime scenes. Steve Dettelbach, director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, says the alarming trend underscores the need for people to safely secure their firearms. Nearly 122,000 guns were reported stolen in 2022. Donna Warder, Washington.
In Washington, I'm Jeff Custer. This is VOA News.
Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on African News Tonight.
I had to go back to the drawing board. Are you ready to repeat several years back so that you can learn a new language and continue medicine? I was like, I could still help people. There is a lot of masters in public health. There is international business management. I can help in opening businesses and helping in opening hospitals and helping like make managing the hospitals to make sure that they provide actually proper care to people.
That's Tanzanian student Nen Yorata Tiveli talking about her dream of becoming a doctor being disrupted by the war in Ukraine. Details coming up. Also, the European Union says it will end its military training mission in Mali. And female workers, according to reports in Eswatini, endure deplorable working conditions. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story in eastern Libya, where General Khalifa Haftar, commander of the self-proclaimed Libyan National Army, is backed by the Russian military. Some regional security analysts estimate the Russian presence ranges from 1,000 to 1,500 individuals. Air bases such as Al-Jufra facilitate Russian military flights, serving as layover stops before flights go on to other African nations. Wolfgang Poschtei, senior advisor at the Austrian Institute for Security and European Policy, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi whether that presence obstructs efforts to unify Libya's rival governments.
Yes, sure. Haftar needs the Russian mercenaries, especially as a backbone for his air force, to counter any eventual war with Western Libya. And the Russians are some kind of insurance for him. In return, he allows the Russians, as said, the use of bases to support the other mercenary operations in Africa. Consequently, any settlement in Libya which could make the Russian military support to the LNA dispensable is not in the interest of Moscow. But keeping the good relationship of the Russians with the government in Tripoli, with the Dabeba government, in mind, I would not bet that the President Dabeba or a government under one of the most of the other presidential candidates would kick out the Russian mercenaries from Libya. It could very well be that they would still allow them to use Libya as a base for their other operations in Africa. I would say Moscow is playing in a very clever way both sides of the Libyan conflict.
Some analysts say Russia's control over a portion of diamond mines, oil reserves, and valuable mineral deposits in Africa provides a strong incentive for levering military strength in Africa. Does that mean the African Corps represents a calculated move to secure and expand Russian interests in Africa?
Absolutely. They are undermining the American and the Western European presence and influence in Africa. This is very much in the interest of Russia. Altogether, the competition between Russia and the West in Africa is about obtaining resources and denying them to the other side. The Russian mercenaries are paid in part by giving them access to gold and diamond mines and so on in their respective countries. In Niger, the Russians will certainly also aim for control over the uranium mines near Alit, probably in cooperation with Iran. Those mines were until a few years ago of critical importance to the French nuclear industry and might now be exploited by Iran. The, from a Russian point of view, for the time being successful pattern of sending mercenaries in return to access to resources will be certainly repeated in other countries on the target list of the Africa Corps, much to the dismay of the West.
In the wake of the coup in Niger, the United States and France are actively exploring alternative countries to host their drone bases for counterterrorism and surveillance missions. The United States agreed to withdraw its more than 1,000 troops from Niger, upending its posture in West Africa, where Niger was home to a major drone base. Does that effectively mark a new regional gain for Russia, which has ramped up its focus on Africa and backed military regimes in neighboring Mali and Burkina Faso?
Yes, it does. This is certainly a significant setback for the Americans and a new gain for Russia, a very important new gain for Russia. The United States has lost its key drone base for surveillance of terrorists and of Russian military activities in the Sahara region. American and French intelligence from the drones and from other assets was shared on a need-to-know principle with the governments in the region to make their counterterrorism operations more efficient. I don't think that the Russians will be able to make up for this support with their own capabilities. I am pretty sure that the population of these African countries will learn rather soon that the Russian kinetic approach, ignoring sustainable development in these countries, will not improve the living circumstances in the long run. On the other side, I would say the corrupt governments will certainly benefit much more from the Russians, as will Al-Qaeda and ISIS from the absence of the Americans.
So with this Russian expansion in Africa, what should the U.S. do to counter that?
The United States needs to find an entirely new approach, which is not only a military approach and which is more focused on improving the living circumstances of the population. You could call it also to win back the hearts and minds of the local population. It's necessary by a sustainable strategy, improving the economy in these countries to win better position in countering the Russian influence. The Russians, as said, betting more or less only on the military approach. What the West needs now is a comprehensive approach to counter. Unfortunately, I don't see this even on the horizon.
That was Wolfgang Porstai, senior advisor at the Austrian Institute for Security and European Policy, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. The war between Russia and Ukraine is in its second year, and many African students who had to leave for safety find themselves back in their home countries and feel largely ignored. Reporter Lulu Sanga caught up with one student whose dream of becoming a doctor has been disrupted and her future is uncertain.
25 years old, Nenyurata Teveli is enjoying a sunny day in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. She had been away in Ukraine for 4 years, studying to become a medical doctor, till February 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine, ending her studies and thrusting her future into uncertainty. Tearing up, Teveli recounts her escape from Ukraine.
I remember I walked for 12 hours. I could see the border, like where we were going to enter, but my legs are giving up. Like, I'm not used to walking for so long. And I remember I called my dad and I was telling him that I just wanna like rest a bit. And my dad was like, no, when you stop, you're not gonna get up. So you just have to continue.
Remembering the February 2022 phone from their terrified daughter, Nyagusi Teveli says he and his wife didn't sleep for days, fearing that their daughter might not make it out of Ukraine alive.
The time was very hard for us as parents. Her mother was faint because she saw that her daughter is going to die. We kept encouraging each other.
From Ukraine, Teveli crossed to Poland and then Italy, from where she flew back to Tanzania. Grateful to have survived, she held on to her dream of completing her studies. After a few weeks of resting and healing, Teveli applied to other universities in the European Union. But finding a place was not easy.
I did a lot of interviews. I did a lot of countries. I got some universities, but most of them were suggesting that I should go back like years back in order to learn the language so that I could be able to do my clinicals, because it's really hard doing clinicals in most EU countries. English is their second language. Most of them have their own official languages. So I just came back home.
According to Ukrainian State Center for International Education, Teveli is just one of about 10,000 African students who were studying in Ukraine before the war. Left with few choices, Teveli, like many others, switched to alternative pathways to continue her studies and rebuild her future. But language was not the only obstacle.
For non-EU citizens, we know the school fees is really high if you're going to study medicine, so it was one of the challenges that most Tanzanians faced. Most Tanzanians that I know ended up changing their course of direction. So people who are into medicine transferred into nursing schools or transferred into psychiatry or psychology.
After some soul-searching, Teveli concluded that while she might not become a medical doctor, she could still help to improve the healthcare system in her country. Thus, she changed her perspective.
I had to go back to the drawing board. Like, are you ready to repeat several years back so that you can learn a new language and continue medicine? I was like, I could still help people. There is a lot of masters in public health. There is international business management. I can help in opening businesses and helping in opening hospitals and helping like make managing the hospitals to make sure that they provide actually proper care to people.
Painful as it was starting over, Tevely accepted a scholarship in France to study international business management. Now in her third year, Tevely, who is home for a short break, says she no longer thinks of going back to Ukraine or studying medicine. According to the Ukrainian State Center for International Education, there are more than 51,000 foreign students in Ukraine, compared to more than 84,000 before the war. Nigeria and Morocco are among the top five countries of African students in Ukraine. Reporting for VOA Africa, I am Lulu Sanga in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
The European Union says it will end its military training mission in Mali, reflecting a deterioration in relations between the bloc and the West African country's military junta. Reuters reports that the EU's diplomatic service said the mission will end when its mandate expires on May 18th. For 11 years, the mission trained Malian armed forces and members of the G5 Sahel, a multinational counter-terrorism force. The EU suspended the mission in 2022 after the junta said it was pulling out of the G5 Sahel. The EU said it has decided not to extend the mission's mandate following a strategic review and consultations with Malian authorities, also taking into account the evolution of the political and security situation on the ground. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. In the textile industry of Eswatini, thousands of female workers, including 28-year-old single mother Nil Iswa Dalabini, endure deplorable conditions. The workers say they face the unhygienic work environments, low pay, excessively long unpaid hours, harsh discrimination, and unjust dismissals. These workers assert that corruption and inadequate regulations enable companies to exploit them. Nukania Musi reports from the industrial hub of Matsapa.
A group of female workers stands outside the New Life Garments textile factory in Matsapa. Clutching their termination letters in frustration, they demand to speak with their employer. The annual export volume of textiles and apparel from Eswatini is estimated to be around $20 million, and the nation's key trading partners include South Africa, the United States, and the United Kingdom. But behind the glittering facade of the fashion industry, a darker truth is emerging. The workers who sew the clothes claim they work in unsafe and unsanitary conditions. They are paid less than the minimum wage, and many work more than 12 hours a day without receiving overtime pay. There have been a number of protests and strikes by textile workers over the past few years. In 2019, textile workers went on strike for nearly a month to demand higher wages and better working conditions. In 2021, there was another major strike by textile workers who demanded an end to discrimination and harassment in the workplace. These strikes have shown the determination of textile workers to fight for their rights despite facing alleged intimidation and violence from their employers. Wanda Mkonza is the Secretary General of the Amalgamated Trade Union of Swaziland, ATUSWA, which negotiates on behalf of about 22,000 workers in the textile industry and others in the manufacturing and processing sector.
We need a fair ground to exist. That is all that we need. We need a creation of a platform where an individual right to freedom of association and collective bargaining shall be respected and actually ensured that it is respected. In that vein, we call for a tripartite inspectorate within the Ministry of Labour.
Despite numerous attempts to reach out to the Ministry of Labour for comments, they declined to provide a statement on the matter. In the meantime, the Conciliation Mediation Arbitration Commission, CMARC, a government entity under the Ministry of Labour tasked with improving workplace relations by facilitating communication and resolving disputes between employees and employers, plays a crucial role in maintaining workplace fairness by resolving disputes and ensuring compliance with labor laws. The commission plans to be proactive in engaging stakeholders to mitigate these issues through training and seminars. Nokukhanya Musi, VOA News, Matsapa, Eswatini.
In the U.S. presidential race between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, there will be 2 million more Asian American voters than there were 4 years ago, according to the Pew Research Center. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns reports on how Asian American lawmakers are getting out the vote.
Asian Americans are the fastest growing group of eligible voters in the United States, according to the Pew Research Center, but they are not uniform in their politics. Christine Chen is executive director of the nonpartisan Asian Pacific Islander American Vote Group.
So typically, Indians and Japanese Americans are biggest supporters of Democrats, and Vietnamese Americans are actually large supporters of Republicans. Now, Chinese Americans, they have shifted from being Democrat to now their largest identification is independent. So what that is also telling me is that there's not enough engagement by the political parties and the campaigns to be able to educate them on the issues and what their campaign actually stands for.
Michelle Steele was born in South Korea and raised in Japan. The Republican congresswoman represents parts of California's Orange County and has Vietnamese language content on her website, as her district is home to one of the largest Vietnamese American communities in the United States.
You just go out there, each community, and you reach out in different way. Like, for Vietnamese Americans, I have 5 outies and you wear their outfit. You go into Filipino community, I wear sari. And you know what? You do all these things and they know that you are one of them.
Steele says she and her supporters knocked on more than 190,000 doors during her reelection campaign 2 years ago.
That's the way you reach out to Asian American communities. It's all same for, in my district, we speak 7 different languages, but they all say the same thing.
That door-to-door campaigning is especially important for Asian voters, of whom more than 70% used mail-in ballots and early voting in 2020, according to Chen.
It's because when you have a mail-in ballot, you can sit at your kitchen table, talk to your family and friends about the issues, about the candidates, and really be able to get the translation help and be able to not be under pressure to be able to figure out who you're going to vote for.
The importance Republicans are placing on Asian American voters concerns Grace Meng, a Democratic U.S. congresswoman who represents a district in the New York City borough of Queens.
Well, I think there's been an increased sense of urgency lately because we have seen the Republican Party, some of their candidates doing that type of multilingual outreach. And so we've been saying to our own Democratic leaders and candidates, like, look, hey, we can't wait anymore. The other side is catching on, and we need to make sure that we're doing that outreach so people know which party truly stands and represents their values.
At the neighborhood Minh Quan Center for Community Action, Sandra Choi is Civic Participation Director.
We work on it year after year, here building political power for immigrants, for
Asian American immigrants, for working class communities, but especially for the 2024 election, where there is so much on the line, we know that this is the moment to really mobilize our communities to understand their power in building something bigger, a bigger future for all of us this year.
Pew Research projections say 15 million Asian Americans will be eligible to vote this November. More than half of them live in just five states: California, New York, Texas, Hawaii, and New Jersey. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Reporting on our planet has become a risky business, according to a new report. It finds that hundreds of journalists worldwide have been attacked and dozens killed over the past 15 years, covering issues like climate change, mining, and deforestation. Lisa Bryant has the story from Paris.
The survey by the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, and the International Federation of Journalists offers a chilling snapshot of the dangers of environmental journalism, along with the risk posed by environmental skeptics and deniers of key issues like climate change. Guilherme Canella leads UNESCO's Freedom of Expression and Safety of Journalists section. The study's findings are based on interviews with more than 900 journalists reporting on environmental issues in 129 countries between 2009 and 2023. They show a sharp rise in attacks by more than 40% over the last 5 years. That includes everything from physical attacks like assaults and arrests to lawsuits and digital or online aggression. Over the past 15 years, it finds 44 journalists have been killed and another 39 jailed covering environmental stories. A case in point, Canella says, was the 2022 killing of British journalist Dom Phillips, who was investigating the environmental devastation in the Amazon. Phillips had received death threats before his death. Brazilian police have arrested several suspects since his killing. Canella can only theorize about why environmental attacks are rising. Additionally, environmental reporting often means going to remote locations. The report notes that small, underfunded news outlets and independent reporters tend to be those covering environmental stories, making them all the more vulnerable to danger. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Paris.
VOA. VOA Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.
A plane carrying 78 passengers skidded off a runway before takeoff at Senegal's main airport today, injuring 11 people and bringing the facility to a halt. The Blaise Dagani Airport says an investigation is underway to determine the cause of the accident, which occurred as the Transair-owned Boeing 737-300, chartered by Air Senegal, was preparing to fly to Mali. A video shared on social media shows a plane with the logo of Senegal-based airline Transair standing in grass with a wing covered in fire-suppressing foam. Reuters was not immediately able to verify the video. The airport statement says it activated emergency protocols to evacuate passengers. Authorities say the airport is closed but will reopen in a few hours.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Ihayes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Bob Bass, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.